is KQKEY, KQLIW.
An antenna that's been around a long time, and I suggested this. I think this may be the one they may have seen out on the web. I suggested this to a few people. Is an end fed deaf antenna fed with open open wire feeders. In other words, taking a piece of wire, say 60, 70, whatever length you can make the flat top as long as possible. You come to the insulator. At that point, you go down with that same piece of wire to the shack. You now come up with another piece of wire parallel to that piece of wire with spaces anywhere between 4 and 6 inches, and you just go to the other end of the insulator and the short piece of wire where the insulator is tied off to the support structure goes into the balance input of a tuner, and it will work phenomenally well. That's an old system. This is the NFED ZEP of the 1930s. Pick over.
Would you say in that case, Mel, the real counterpoise for the horizontal radiator section is that vertical piece of wire hanging down to the shack? Would you call that possibly the counterpoise? Go ahead.
I guess you can call it. Some people have called it a top-loaded, a top-loaded vertical. But you have, in other words, you have two parallel wires. Yeah, in other words, you're having approximately around 600 ohm feed of point from the ZEP antenna. But it also now will give you a great matching to a balanced input. You don't have to use coax at all, Vic. Over.
Okay, so I've got 600 ohm open wire line. I've got the right kind of a antenna tuner, which has a balanced 600 ohm output. My two wires of my 600 ohm line go up the mast to the point where I feed the NFED ZEP. One of those 600 ohm open wire ladder line wires goes to the antenna. Does the other wire go anywhere, Mel? Go ahead.
Really, just hangs there through a short piece of wire, you know, between the insulator and the support structure. Dick, over.
Okay, you can get away with things like that with 600 ohm line. If you did that with coax, I think it'd be, if you wanted high performance, I think you'd be forced into making a real counterpoise for the shielded section of the coax. And to really be double darn sure, you should put a ballooning device on there, too, to try to stop the coax from being hot. But NFED ZEPs were very popular at one time, and for some reason they're less used today, but maybe it's time for them to be brought back to life. I think we should go over to the space report from Paul. I'll come back and ask if there's any further questions on this subject, and then we'll go to the write-in question. So, Paul, WS2N, are you ready to tell us what's going on in space? K2LIW in the tech pad.
Dick, you put me at the end of the list, but go ahead with Paul and then go back to me.
You're on. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Rich, and good evening, Mel. One topic I wanted to cover just was the Phoenix Mars landing mission, which landed in May. They successfully dug up some soil, and in that soil they finally got it into the Tiger device, the oven type of. There's really like 8 ovens aboard the Phoenix. Small oven. They've been having trouble getting the dirt into it. The dirt has been sticky. Into the Tiger unit the way they thought it was going to originally. By the way, the Tiger unit is the thermal and evolved gas analyzer, they call it. Just 8 little ovens, one-time use per oven. So a week and a half ago, they put some of the soil in, and sure enough, they did detect water in that soil, which is the first time they really can confirm that they have detected the water. They've seen the ice on the planet, little tiny cubes. They disappeared after 4 days, so they know that they evaporated, they turned to water, they just turned to a gas, and went off in the atmosphere. But this actually confirms it with their chemical analyzer. So I thought that was pretty good. Subsequently, since that, they did find some kind of salt mixed in with the soil and drop it, which is kind of on a toxic side. So the assumption is that this type of salt-like material is all throughout the planet. It wouldn't bode well to try to find any kind of life on the planet, any microbial life. So, but you know, they are in one area, and they're going to dig maybe another area and take a look, see what they can come up with. They also have a 5-week extension. I remember on this now we talked about that one. When they first landed, you know, the possibility of them going on. It's originally a 3-month mission. Solar cells are working good, so they've already contracted for another 5 weeks. And you know how that goes. They'll try to extend it beyond or as far as the machine will go. It's a lot less expensive than putting another one up there. Just keep it going until it quits. Just like the two rovers that are up there, they're still riding around. Spirit and Opportunity. I just want to bring that up. Next manned space shuttle mission will be in October, and that will be for the Hubble. We'll talk plenty about that when that comes up. Dick. Back to you. This is WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. I wonder if you've heard that report, which either is or is not confirmed, that NASA had a special meeting with the science officers of the President of the United States, because not only do they detect water, but there's something else that they wanted to investigate further. And I think they're predicting that the official announcement for whatever else they detected will be made in September. I wonder if you've heard any of those reports, and if you've got any guesses as to what that could be, Paul. WS2N, KQLIW.
No, not at all. I'll definitely look into that. Did you just hear that recently, Dick, or in the last day or two, or how long back is this information gone?
1 week ago. I think I heard about it last Friday or Saturday of a week ago, and on the last TechNet we did mention this, that there was a special report made between NASA and the President's Science Committee about what they detected in that first oven. I know that there was at least 2 TIGER experiments that I think have taken place. One, they finally got some soil into the TIGER oven and detected the water. And I know they have the ability to mix water that they brought along with them into the soil to see what would happen. And I am speculating that they mixed water into the soil and something was given off that they consider significant with reference to either past life or the potential for life. That's my guess. The salt that you're talking about that is potentially toxic, have they detected what kind, have they mentioned what kind of salt that is, Paul? Go ahead.
It's, I forget the chemical name, but, whatever, it's used in rocket engines. Usually solid fuel with rocket engines. And some speculation, but maybe when they landed these 12 landing rockets, because it, you know, they were pulsing rockets, but it turns out those rockets that they used do not have any of this type of material in it. It cannot create it when it hits the soil, like what they have on Mars. So whatever it is, it's part of Mars. It's some kind of a highly toxic material for life, whatever it is. I'll have to check the internet again on exact chemical name. That's not good. So I hope that was the report. But you said September. If it's an important announcement like that, to wait all the way till September, that's going to be hard to keep that a secret.
K1FC. Go right ahead, Deb. I'll give us your full call and name, and then proceed.
Yeah, this is K1FC. Name is Fred. And the chemical was sold as perchlorate, and it doesn't, while it's not, doesn't totally preclude life. Some of the initial reports kind of exaggerated the situation, but there are on the internet some more balanced reports on it, and there was an issue whether it could have come, because perchlorate sometimes are used in rocket propellants, but there are actually bacteria on Earth that exist that can break it down and live off of it. So it is not, does not exclude life. Thank you, Dick.
Very fine, Fred. You and I haven't had that talk for a long time. Is perchlorate a organic substance, or would you consider it an inorganic substance? Fred, go ahead.
No, it's inorganic. But it can be broken down as a source for oxygen.
Very good. I wonder if you've heard of some of those highly speculative blog reports about life possibly having been discovered, or the past life being discovered. This report about the information that was given to the Science Committee of the President, and they want to study the material a lot longer to make sure they're not making a premature report, and they're predicting that there's going to be a report in September about something else they found. I wonder if you've heard any of those signals. Fred, go ahead.
No, I haven't. I mean, I heard rumors, but I haven't seen anybody with authority that could say anything. Recommend that you keep up with these things, to check Phil Plate's Bad Astronomy site and the related science blog.
Very fine, Fred. KC2OJO, Howie, was that you just calling in?
Yes, Dick. Just a quick comment. After you mentioned, I believe that report about the possibility of something very unusual being reported to the President first appeared in, I think it isn't happened, but the people at NASA who are evaluating the data fight vigorously that there was any report to any committee of this type or that for the higher up. I guess if you want to be a little paranoid, it's supposed to be. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. But right now, the responsible people at NASA are...
Thank you for that, Howard. Now, Aviation Week and Space Technology is no flim-flam machine, magazine. That's a substantial journal by my standards. I mean, that's the aviation equivalent of the New York Times. So the fact that they had the report there tells me that I think there's a good chance something significant did take place. Of course, the people knowing that little bit of information then went off with some pretty wild speculations. Everything up to, you know, little green men were found walking around the planet. I think NASA was trying to avoid a whole lot of misinformation. I still think there's a chance that some kind of a further report will come out in September. Something to look forward to. The fact that water is there on the planet is a very good sign about the possibility of past life having been there. It sort of confirms what has been seen now for a couple of years, and that is there are a number of depressions in Mars which have at their rim what looks like flowing water left trails, if you know what I mean, as if frozen water had bubbled up to the surface, flowed for a while, made certain trails, and then either evaporated or disappeared or whatever. So there are water marks, lots of water marks on Mars. It's the only clear explanation for some of the topography they have seen. And now that they've seen water in the North Polar region, sure, it certainly says that's a plausible explanation. There are a good number of people who believe there's a substantial amount of frozen water in the form of ice below the surface of Mars. Mars has great difficulty holding on to its water, just like it has great difficulty holding on to its atmosphere, for two or three reasons. Let me drop. Those reasons are, It has half the diameter of Earth, therefore it has lower gravity. It has a frozen core that's no longer molten, therefore without a molten core that flows, it doesn't have a magnetic field. Without a magnetic field, it doesn't have the Van Allen belt shield. A very nice thing about our Earth is that it's got a molten core that flows, creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field creates the magnetic shield around our planet, which results in the Van Allen belt. And so an awful lot of heavy particles that come out of the sun at a zillion miles an hour get trapped into that magnetic field, never get a chance to hit our atmosphere. In the case of Mars, that solar wind has been, throughout the millions of years, slowly peeling away the upper levels of the atmosphere, and now Mars has a very tenuous atmosphere, something like 0.7% of the atmospheric pressure we have on Earth. So that's not a very hospitable environment by my standards. It's cold, dry, desert, without much air. Not a great place to send a human being, if you could get them there. And it would require tremendous resources of multiple nations on this planet in order to send a man there. So you guys have heard me say on many occasions, I am predicting, and I hope I'm wrong, but I am predicting that the people living within the sound of my voice are not likely to hear about a man traveling to Mars. To the moon, yes. Mars is probably 100 times more difficult to get there than to the moon. And the moon cost us $33 billion with the Apollo program to get there. 100 times more than that is pretty darn expensive and high in risk to life, even if you could solve a whole bunch of technical problems about going to Mars. So sending robot stations to Mars is a great thing to do, remotely piloted vehicles. But to send a man there, I don't think you get anywhere near the right risk-benefit ratio. Okay, Rich had another question or comment. N2EO, go right ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Getting back to Earth, I have a Johnson Viking Ranger 2 that I'm going to be using paired up with a Collins R398 on 75 meter AM. Had a little sobering experience with it this afternoon. I hooked it up to a Johnson TR switch with the R390, and when I disconnected the coax between the TR switch, I went between the TR switch and the R390 and the Viking Ranger, I got sparks. Good thing I didn't get electrocuted. Sparks between the Johnson and the Collins. Now the Collins has a three-wire plug. The Johnson does not, but I'm going to be putting a three-wire cord on there tomorrow morning. This, I don't know if it's me, I know you're basically a UHF operator, Dick, but this is an AM rig from about 1962. It's got a transformer, so one side of the line does not go to the chassis. The only thing I can think of, they got a brute force filter in there on the AC line with 005 disc capacitors from each side of the line to the chassis. Do you think I ought to remove those disc ceramics or just forget about it and put a three-wire cord on there? Back to that, and Leo.
Yeah, that's a very popular technique. Even my Heathkit AR3 receiver kit, built in 1956, had something very equivalent. 0.02 microfarad or whatever, just ceramic capacitors from each side of the 110-volt ground line to chassis ground. What that really means is because your 110-volt line has a black wire and a white wire, the black wire is the hot one, the white wire is the one that's essentially grounded, and you've got a capacitor divider network between the two, that means your chassis on a 120-volt line is 60 volts above ground. You could prove this, Rich, by putting those two chassis side by side, but not connecting them together with a coax cable, and put your volt-ohm milliammeter, your triplet model 630 or your Simpson 260 or whatever, or your volt-ohm milliammeter, your digital voltmeter, in the AC scale. simply touch the two chassis when both are plugged in, one with a three-wire plug and one with a two-wire plug, and do it with the two-wire plug first, big blade up and then big blade down, so to speak. But back in the days when two-wire, two-prong plugs were popular, there was an amazing number of cases in which a chassis was 60 volts AC-wise above ground, and that represents a bit of a shock hazard. I can remember on a couple of occasions touching the chassis of my Heathkit AR-3 in my youth while I'm standing on the basement floor with bare feet, because, I'm still in my pajamas. I get up early in the middle of the night, want to do a little bit of listening, and I'm standing on the basement floor. It was a non-tiled floor, and I would touch the chassis, and I would feel the 60 volts. So with your volt ohm milliammeter, you can confirm that. That problem obviously will go away when you put in the third prong. And the third prong, by the way, will be conducting all of that current. Now the chassis will not be 60 volts above ground. It'll be at ground. Therefore, one of those 0.02 microfarad ceramics will have the whole 120 volts across it. And you would, if you wanted to, with your clamp-on ammeter, be able to see that amount of AC current flowing through that third prong, the ground lead. Now you know why, though, three-prong plugs became popular, because there's an amazing number of people who had a shock hazard potential because either the capacitor divider network we're describing, anything above 30 volts, by the way, is potentially lethal in the worst-case situation. Let me drop. And if something goes wrong inside, so that one side of the 110-volt ground line touches chassis ground of a piece of equipment, the whole darn chassis can become hot with 120 volts. Without the three-prong plug, you're not very safe, and people have died because of that, particularly in the case of a drill motor. My goodness. A ridiculous number of people would take an old-fashioned metal-cased drill motor with a two-prong plug. They would stand on the seashore with their feet in salt water, with a sanding disc on the end of that drill motor, sanding the bottom of their drill rowboat that's upside down. What a quick way to die. You really don't want to do that. Nowadays, all of our drill motors have got double insulation, plastic case, and most of them have a three-prong plug besides. And this gives you some clue as to why. So when you get a chance to take your VOM between those two chassis, I think you're going to see something like 60 or 63 volts. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. That's what I thought. I just wanted to double-check it because, it's got a transformer, so the line is isolated. The only thing I could see was the brute force filter. Why did they put that in? I mean, were they really looking for to kill RF on the AC line? Did the FCC make them put that in to type accept the radio?
There, I'm not sure. In the case of a transmitter, to bypass the chassis to stop your 110-volt line from becoming part of the transmitting antenna, that's a good thing to do. In the case of a receiver, there's all kinds of noises on the 110-volt line, which would act like an antenna and bring that into your receiver. By putting those bypass capacitors, you stop it at that point. So it's really to stop RF from flowing out and in. But it's got this nasty characteristic of it makes the chassis float 60 volts above ground, AC-wise, and anything above 28 volts is considered potentially lethal. Back to you, Rich.
All right, Dick. So I'm safe then if I put a three-wire cord and leave the brute force filter, Roger?
That's my recommendation. You'll have twice the number of volts flowing across one of those ceramics and 0 volts essentially across the other one. But if they were properly rated, that should give you no problem. Go ahead.
All right, Dick. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And we'll be listening to the rest of the net until we help.
Okay, Terry, Jack. Eric recognized, in fact, there already was 120 volts across one of those capacitors when you grounded that chassis by connecting it to another piece of equipment that had a three-prong plug. Eric, you got it.
There's something you could add to that. If you don't mind spending, what is it, $6 or $7, you buy an EMI filter with a three-prong plug device, receptacle, which you use a power cord for. Those EMI filters are very good, and they don't leak anything into the ground, so you don't have the potential problem. The other thing, if you're really into old radios, what you really ought to do is keep some isolation transformers around. They're very handy. And sometimes they can save your life. Get your IWK, TJ.
Now, there's a kind of EMI filter that you mount right on the chassis, and you bring a three-prong female plug up to it. And it's got male prongs on the chassis. And I guess you're describing another kind of device which looks a little bit like a wall wart, and it's got a EMI filter built in. Give me a couple more words on that one, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's a standard. You find it in just about everything that's professionally made today. It's a standard EMI filter. It mounts on the chassis. It's got the three prongs and the square rectangle trapezoid kind of look. And, you know, it's the standard way of keeping RF in and out. Out. And keeping it in.
That's ATP wireless comment.
No recognize, but first, Eric, you said that that's only $3. I'm amazed. That looks like $10 or $15 worth of hardware to me. Are you sure that some place where I could buy it for $3 and change? Chassis mounted EMI filter with, say, 5 or 10 amp capability. Go ahead.
Give me a minute. I'll give you the DigiKey part number. I think it's like $7 or $8. It's not $3.
Okay. Still sounds good. Sounds like a good investment. Mel, you got it.
Okay. A number of these devices, in fact, that you use in some of the old rigs that use the power transformer, they recommend that you put it MOV, metal oxide, varactive, or whatever the heck they call them, to take the spikes out. I understand a number of these little devices, boxes that they have that you can find like in a computer monitor or all this, usually a square unit mounted up against the chassis, held with maybe a couple of ribbons, has a couple of wires in, a couple of wires out, have MOVs in a stick over.
Oxide
varistors. Yep, metal oxide varistors. And they're pretty good at removing spikes. And the spikes that they want to remove are not only the spikes that you couple in from the outside world, like if lightning strikes your 110-volt line a block away, but second of all, if your piece of electronics contains a transformer, and if you happen to open up the on-off switch at the instant of time that the 110-volt line is going through 0 volts. It's kind of hard to believe, but 0 volts is the critical time for a transformer, because that's when the current is maximum. And so you get the maximum stored energy in the magnetic field of the transformer as you're going through 0 volts of a loco or Con Ed supply. And you open up the on-off switch at that time. In some cases, you'll get an inductive kickback from that transformer, which could give some grief to some other portion of your circuitry. That's one of the disadvantages of using a transformer. In the case of a capacitor input filter network, you've got an automatic clamping and damping network there. But the really professional pieces of electronics will have a choke input filter, particularly a broadcast transmitter. In the case of a broadcast transmitter, if there's a power transformer involved, my guess is the magnetic field that it can store is quite substantial. And they know that almost all broadcast transmitters use choke input filter networks. So therefore, the stored energy of that transformer is something that's got to be reckoned with. I bet you guys have done some special things to take care of that. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No comment, Dick.
Rich recognized, but Eric first, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking for a part number for you. Okay, yeah.
Okay, yeah. We'll take Rich in the meantime. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, what you're saying about maximum current, minimum voltage at the 0 point, that's true, but you gotta remember on the vintage stuff, they're using 5R4, 5U4 rectifiers, so it's a soft start.
Agreed. The transformer going into a tube-type rectifier is a lot softer on current inrush than you would have with modern-day silicon diodes. But that's not the only reason why broadcast transmitters tend to use choke input. All really high-power electronics that has to rectify a sine wave of voltage in order to create DC voltage to run their transmitter, if it was a single phase, then they would certainly use choke input. Three-phase, full wave rectification, which gives you 6 pulses per cycle, it's not quite as required. Still, though, to control power factor, I'll bet they still use choke input. A choke input power supply fed with even a 3-phase transformer, at least one of those phases is going through maximum stored magnetic field at the instant you open up the switch. So if you really open up a thorough on-off switch, as opposed to slowly cranking a variac to ground, I'll bet you the inductive kickback of the transformer could create some grief. Eric, when he gets a chance, maybe he's going to comment on that. KQRIW in the TechNet.
All right, I'll answer that.
You got it, Eric.
Now, you know, if you look at RCA transmitters and a few others from the 70s, you'll find exactly what you're talking about. But today we do something called step start. It depends upon how big your transmitter is. I mean, if you're doing 30 or 60 kilowatts, you tend to do a step start with relay, sometimes with big resistors, believe it or not. And essentially, we bring it up very slowly. And at some point when the filament's hot enough, it should be, in the case of my transmitter, 10 minutes later, then it'll allow you to turn the high voltage on. By the way, the high voltage is like outside in the wind. It looks like a big electric transformer. But you think about it, it's a little bit of power. It's 30,000 volts and about 4 amps. You can figure out how many watts that is.
Yeah, that's input power. That's a lot of steam. Did LIPA give you a power interruption between 7:30 and 8 o'clock, roughly, last Friday night? Eric, go ahead.
No, actually, we got hit at about 12:50. I didn't come back until about 8:30, and that was on the 7th, so that was, what, Thursday.
I thought it was Friday. I did see an outage on Channel 21 on Friday. No, you're right. You're right. I think it was on Thursday. Yeah, there was a really good nova I wanted to see on the dimming of the sun. And I guess it was the nova that came on at 8 o'clock on Thursday night, and I was worried that I wouldn't get a chance to see it. But you guys did come on in time. So I think you're saying that at the present time, you don't have a standby generator when LIPA goes down. Is that true?
That's correct. But once we build the backup facility for the 13 international stuff that we do, then it will not only be a generator, it'll be probably a 200 kVA UPS and a generator, which will make quite a bit of difference.
Wow. That 200 kVA UPS, that's capable of running, what, 20 minutes or so on battery power?
Well, let's see. In New York, I bought 175 kVA UPS. And the last, when I left there, it runs the place for about 45-50 minutes. And that's probably drawing about maybe 125 kVA, something like that.
Do you go to a lower power transmitter setting when you're on the UPS? And by the way, is that UPS all located at Empire?
Actually, no. I'm just talking about the on-air facility, not the transmitter. You know, they also provide services to the rest of the PBS network. One of them being called Create, another one World. So it's sort of like, you know, being a national place, you don't kind of want to lose power. It wouldn't be a good thing. The transmitter Empire is connected to the power lines. Let's see, PIS and NBC have generators up there right alongside the transmitter.
But I think you're saying the other network might not have either UPS or standby generators. So if Con Ed goes down at Empire, I know they got a separate generator for the elevator, but if Con Ed goes down, do certain stations go off the air?
Yeah, that's kind of been known to happen. Even when the people who have generators, they don't generally run UPSs, so, you know, the transmitter will go down for a couple minutes before it comes back up.
is the Department of Homeland Security concerned about that, and have they made suggestions for any changes, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, you know, I could give you a whole lot of stories about those silly people, but I'd rather not.
Okay. Save those stories for when you and I have an eyeball. I'd like to hear them. And I'd also like to hear a little bit about our buddy at National Association, NAB, our common buddy at NAB. I think you had an interface with him a couple months ago, and I've never had a chance to discuss that with you. Rich, let's see now. Did we cover Rich's question? I'm not sure if we did or not. N2EO, just in case. K2RYW.
Yeah, I'm satisfied, Dick. What Eric said is a good idea with the prepared EMI show. The thing is, I want to keep the radio, you know, for its historical value. I want to keep it original. So I am definitely going to put a three-wire cord on it. That much I'll give in to, Dick. But, you know, I don't want to start drilling holes and mounting. The rest of it I'm going to leave alone because, I mean, in theory, a two-wire, not that I would do it, but a two-wire plug can always be put back.
Yep, I see your thinking on that one. And you won't be doing anything different than what happens when you ground that chassis to another piece of equipment that is grounded. One of those capacitors is getting the full 120 volts. Mel, I think we're going to go ahead of schedule and go right to the mailbag and try to keep those people a little bit happier. And so, has the mail changed at all this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Dick?
Yeah, who's that?
It's me. I found a bunch of different ones, actually. They vary in price. Also, there's some small ones that you could mount inside, take the place of the capacitors, and that's too expensive. There's $13 and $15, okay. And the prices go up from there, but there's the little ones that you could mount inside. But, Rich, you know, if you don't want to mess with the radio, you put your stuff on isolation transformers, and then you don't have to worry about anything. Just ground it.
No, it's a good idea. It's good advice.
The one you could mount inside, though, wouldn't show from the outside of the cabinet. Therefore, the cabinet would look pristine. If I understand you correctly, Eric, you could mount one completely inside and wouldn't even have to drill a square hole in the chassis. Is that true?
Yeah, they look like a little cans with, you know, two little mounting tabs. So you could use You could use double-sided sticky stuff, but they're small. Let's see, the sizes of them are they give it as ABCD. Here's the size. They're pretty small, these things. But they've got two terminals on one side, three terminals on another, on the other, and, you know, the power line goes through the two outsides, and one in the middle goes to the chassis. And also hooks up to, if you want to use a grounded plug, that's kind of the way to go. But you don't have to.
Yeah, with that EMI filter, he still has a pair of capacitors to chassis. And so if he doesn't put in a three-prong plug, he still has the chassis 60 volts above ground, if I understand you correctly. Is that true?
No, they're chokes. They're not caps to ground. These are by power line filters provide superior common mode and premium differential mode attenuation. Exceeded only by that of the Q-series filter, which is another line of filters that they have, blah, blah, blah. So on and so forth. It protects the equipment from malfunctions due to conductive interference into the equipment fiddle lines. Three-phase construction supplies excellent suppression at high frequencies, blah, blah, blah. You get the idea.
Yeah, what brand name is that? And are you sure there isn't still a small capacitor from each side to ground, though, or inside that can?
You know, I couldn't swear to it, but the way it looks like, I'm looking through it. I don't think so, because I've had these things open before, and I've seen it. They're all built around choke. So, what can I tell you? They don't say per se, so I guess that's a risk.
Is that choke wound on a sort of a bipolar winding for the two leads, and it's wound on a ferrite core?
Yes, I believe so. I've seen them come in different forms, but yeah, that's one of them.
And that inexpensive one you described to us, roughly how many amperes is that good for?
Let's see. Oh, here's the dimension. Hello, hi. They don't say. I guess I'd actually have to go look at the actual spec. This is just a catalog of stuff, you know. High performance three phase. They've got three phase lines, so this looks good. High impedance loads. We have one for low impedance loads, high power lines. They come in all different flavors, Dick.
Sounds very good. As you were reading that, you slipped by a word, RoHS. Removal of hazardous substances. And in the industry I'm working in, we are slowly discovering RoHS has got a lot of problems to it. Yeah, you're making an effort to remove lead from the environment by removing lead from the solder that you build circuit boards with. But my goodness, you create a whole host of problems when you remove lead from the solder. The tin whiskers really affects future reliability of electronics. There are a number of military organizations saying you will not obey RoHS with the equipment you send to us. You have to have very high reliability equipment. I wonder if you have any reluctance to use RoHS equipment. Eric, go ahead.
I'll tell you. The fighter paste I use has lead. But one of the things I find about a lot of the RoHS stuff and stuff coming out of Japan is RoHS, period. It ain't coming no other way. That's why you don't get picture tubes from Japan anymore. No lead in the glass. No lead. One of the problems that I find, you know, the temperature, the melting temperature, that stuff is lower the first time. And I find the stuff cracks from vibration pretty easily. How about you, Dick?
I haven't seen the cracks, but I've seen a lot of complaints of whiskers that occur a year or two downrange. Tin whiskers. So RoHS has its problems. Very similar to another section of industry where halon used to be used for fire extinguishing. And almost anything they try to find as a substitute for flame suppression doesn't work anywhere near as well as halon. I'll bet you some of your facilities had halon capability at one time, and you've been looking around for a substitute. Is that true?
No, actually not in the broadcast facility, but when I used to be with the computer graphics center, you know, the video center at Tech, we had lots of halon systems. Those things were fun. Actually, that's the best stuff in the world, but as you suffocate if you happen to be too nearby.
WA2CDL. Andy and Joe in that order. Andy, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I didn't need to go with Joe. Hello. I just finally got home, turned the radio on. How you doing? And I heard Eric, I just wanted to get my message. I guess you notice it's not in net mode. Yeah, Dick.
I didn't notice because I always run PL tone, but yeah, I guess people without a 136.5 PL haven't been able to sign in. Maybe that's why Joe talked to me on the output frequency. Joe, you want to make a comment? Go ahead on the input frequency. To be 2RYY, K2RYW. Yes, I can. Joe is talking to me on the output frequency. He's nearby. And because we're not in the net mode, there's no way that Joe can get in to either out east or this repeater. So Joe wants to make sure you know that, Andy. To the A2CDL, A2RIW.
4IRLP connection either, WD2HWW. Okay, yeah, it was, I got a call stating that the IRLP was down and the clock wasn't set and a couple of things. And, you know, all these technical things come up. And, I guess it's one thing after another. Okay, all right, yeah, I was aware of it. And I made mention to Eric earlier today. All right, I just signed in. Boy, I just wanted to mention, because I'm a little bit under the weather. I'm finding a cold all week. And my voice, I don't want to use my voice too much. So I just wanted to mention, if it has not been mentioned, had a beautiful viewing of the space station as it flew by at 8:30 p.m. Thursday evening. And watched it come up over the horizon. Literally flew right over my house, and it was just, the timing was perfect because the sun was setting, and you could really see it really bright in the sky and really make it out. So, stupid, I didn't know their frequencies at the time. I could have pointed a beam up to them, Dick, and given one of the astronauts a shout on the air if he was listening. But I don't know what their schedule is for hamming down to space, but it was a really nice sight. Thank you,
Dick. Sounds like it was a great viewing. I wonder if you had a chance to view it with binoculars, Andy. Were you able to make out any details, or was it just a bright, white, round object in the sky? Go ahead.
No, I did not have binoculars. This was with the naked eye, just standing in my backyard. And you could clearly see the shape of it. Almost making out the solar panels. I mean, the thing is huge. I mean, I don't know exactly what the size of it is. You would probably know, because I did not look up the actual physical size of the structure, but of course, as they add on more to it, it's getting larger and larger. And, you know, given the rate of speed it is traveling, there was a plane that was traveling in the opposite direction that forced its path, and you can see the difference in the speed of that compared to the plane, and obviously in the distance in height. I think it's what, 120 miles up or so. And it was moving quite fast. We had about a 6 minute window, which is pretty long, you know, given the location relative to our location at the time. So it was good. And you could, again, I saw it just with the naked eye. I did not use any binoculars. It clearly made me out. It was relatively bright. Back to you.
And you said it flew directly over your house. Do you mean that literally? In other words, it went to 90 degrees of elevation, Andy? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say so. From north to west to southeast, and I look straight up, directly upward to see it.
Okay, Paul, if you happen to be there, roughly how many feet is the maximum dimension from one corner to the other corner of the International Space Station? WS2M, K2RIW.
By the way, Dick, it'll work now.
Okay, Dick, we'll be good. Somebody else came in there, Dick?
Yeah, according to Eric, the machine has been restored to the net mode. Roughly how many feet is there from corner to corner on the International Space Station, Paul?
Okay, if you look at the panels, there's been three sets of panels that have been brought up by three different space shuttles. But now each set of panels consists of two panels each. So that is, so there's two for the first set, two for the second set, two for the third set, and eventually there's going to be another set.
each one of these per set is 200 feet long by 40 feet wide. And then the other one is, again, 200 feet long and 40 feet wide. That consists of one set. And there's another set, exactly the same measurement, 200 by 40. And the next one is 200 by 40. Now you go over to the fourth side, and it's the same thing. You've got the one set over there, 200 by 40, 200 by 40, and you've got one more that's going to be brought up next year, one more set just like that. So that's why the panels are so dominant. For end to end for the panels, I think you're up to 240 feet, if I'm not wrong. Will eventually be over 300 feet along the truss work. And then going back from the front back, you've got probably equally, I would say the equal length of 200 feet of living space between the Russian Zvezda, which was the first one brought up there, that's hooked up to another module called the Zarya functioning cargo block. That's like the machine room of the International Space Station. That's another big block, same big size, and then that's connected to a node, and that node is another little room along the six sides to it, and that's connected to the Destiny Lab. Let me drop it. Again, the Destiny Lab is another 23-foot piece, 14 feet diameter. And that in turn is connected to the Harmony node, another little room. And then that again is coming out from that. You've got the Columbus module now, which is now attached, huge module. And now the Kaibo by Japan, that's the biggest one yet. That was like 34 feet or something by 14, 15 feet in diameter. All these modules are attached. You've got another room for astronauts to actually stay in overnight before they take EVAs. So the thing got quite huge. I don't know, all kinds of different measurements, but I have to figure that one out. But probably roughly 200 by, call it 220, 230 feet, something like that. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, but I think really from diagonal corner to diagonal corner, I think we have even bigger numbers than that. And I think it's at something like 220 nautical miles of altitude. Big piece of hardware. Hard to believe all that's going to come back someday. Okay, I think we're ready to go over to Mel. Well, let me make sure that we haven't skipped anybody. Have I skipped anybody up till now? KGRIW.
Question on the Rojas, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric. Howie.
Yeah, you know, let me ask you. All these Japanese companies are now doing Rojas. I wonder how the liability is going to be. I'm concerned about buying equipment that uses Rojas because it may not work as well.
I guess there's some yeses and noes to that. I noticed that my audio was going up and down. I'm wondering why. The audio coming through the machine has got two different levels, I see. I guess it's a function of whether or not somebody's on the other input. The reliability could be pretty good. The place where people are having trouble is in fancy integrated circuits, which have got extremely small spacings inside. And with the smallest amount of contamination, you grow thin whiskers that eventually create short circuits within the integrated circuit itself. I don't think I would worry too much about this, Howie. It's only for a really tough environment where the problem is severe. Your house in Brooklyn is not that tough an environment, it says here. Mel, what kind of mail have you gotten this week? And hopefully it's a little bit more complimentary. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, yeah, quite a bit, a lot of controversy. There's a tremendous amount of controversy. let's see, about 67 emails. Yeah, I'd say break it down. It's quite a number of pros and cons to our discussion last week. Let me make one comment that Rich had mentioned about antique radios and drilling holes and things or changing. Let me tell you exactly what the Collins collected and talking to them. I've had quite a number of conversations on the Collins net, and also I'll tell you exactly how they have put it. But let me let it drop for a second. Okay, the one thing that they don't look forward to doing is drilling anything that has to do with the cosmetics of the cabinet or the panel or front panel. I had mentioned to them that I had drilled a number of holes in the back of the Collins 7584 receiver to take out and put in different signals on the back skirt. And they said, well, you know, if you did it, you know, with nice neat connectors like RCA type connectors and all or whatever, it's okay because the cosmetics of the cabinet basically are not, you know, in any way destroy the you know, front paneling, sides, tops, or anything like that. So anyway, that's the how they stand, and they okay many electrical changes in rigs over the years to bring them up to more modern standards. By the way, let me let it drop. And so that if you put something like a filter in the on the line there, Rich, it would be okay if you mounted it up there with a couple of small screws through the back panel, you know, through the back skirt of the chassis. I don't think it'd be objective because that's considered a good electrical update. All right. Anyhow, what else? Let me see. Anything else? I can think of. Yeah, one more thing. The filter that is recommended by Collins collectors to add the input of their radios and all consists of basically a capacitor across the line, 0.047 and 250 volts AC, 500 microhenry type of choke, one on each line, and then two capacitors in series, 0.002, 250 volt AC. The center of them connected to the point where the two of them come together, connected to the chassis, and of course a three-prong plug. This is sanctioned by the Collins collectors as a good electrical update, by the way, Dick, over.
Okay, Joe recognized, and I can understand that one. Let's take one or two of the mails, and then we'll go back to Joe's question. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. All right, that's just wanted to bring that out. Let's see. I'm trying to read over questions that you know, direct answers to. I'm not going to get into any controversies at all. And, well, I mean, oh, here's one. I bought at a ham fest a heat kit monitoring scope. It worked well and everything, but when I see a image on the screen, it seems to have like a ghosty effect. My friend said the picture tube is no good. Is this possible? The picture is traced and clean and bright and focuses, but sort of produce the ghosty effect. I know that was a condition that was a number of the CRTs that Pete can use years ago, the 3-inch CRT. Have you heard of that? And I think I know what it is, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think there's two conditions that can give that to you. The primary one is a small amount of gas in the cathode ray tube. A gassy cathode ray tube, it's got a peculiar kind of ghosty emission to it, and when you try to adjust the brilliance and focus, it acts in a slightly peculiar way. Also, if the high voltage power supply for some reason develops a higher than normal impedance, you get a funny ballooning effect as you try to adjust focus and brilliance. But I am guessing there could be a small amount of gas in that cathode ray tube. What do you think, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, these were surplus tubes that were used in that 3-inch monitor. That, you know, you can monitor the transmitted signal or hook it to your receiver and watch the spectrum type of panoramic display. What happened with those CRTs, those 3-inch CRTs, they had a coating inside the tube, this aqueduct coating, and it had a tendency to begin to fall off. And if you look at the tube, you can see it sort of getting clear around the bell of the tube. And that aqueduct coating, when it's lost, will cause that effect as it deteriorates. I think that most likely sounds plausible. If, like you say, if the power supply, everything most likely is working correctly. But I remember that as a complaint on the 3-inch tube that surplus tube that Heathkit was using to pick over.
Yeah, that makes some sense. You have to ground the phosphor on the front face in order for the electrons to go there and hit the phosphor.